From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, hosting today from Louisville Public Media in Louisville, Kentucky. It's Here and Now, and it is an important day for voters here in Kentucky. Primary elections are today for a number of statewide offices, including governor.
And also today, supporters of abortion rights are staging demonstrations against some of those restrictive abortion laws recently passed in 8 states, including Alabama. Alabama's would ban nearly all abortions. Other states like Ohio would ban abortions after a doctor can hear a heartbeat that's around 6 weeks. That's usually before a woman knows she's pregnant, and technically impossible. At that stage, embryos don't have fully formed hearts or a cardiovascular system. The doctor would be listening for fetal pole cardiac activity. Most of the laws do not include an exception for rape or incest, and none have gone into effect. All are being contested, and backers want that. They hope they can head to the conservative majority Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. Lena Wen is the president of Planned Parenthood. In addition to helping low-income people and others with general health care, they do provide abortions, and Planned Parenthood is organizing the protests today. Dr. Wen, CNN's Jeffrey Toobin, the legal analyst, has been very clear. He says in 18 months, there will be no more Roe v. Wade. Do you agree?
That is the threat of our time right now. There's no question that this is a coordinated attack on women's health and rights. These anti-women's health politicians have one goal in mind, to overturn Roe versus Wade. And if that were to happen, then 25 million women will be living in states where abortion is outlawed, criminalized, and banned. Before Roe versus Wade, thousands of women died every year because they did not have access to safe legal abortions. We cannot go back to that time.
Well, Dr. Wen, you look at it this way. As you know, there are others who look at it through a completely different prism. Devil's advocate, we have many forms of birth control now. This isn't the 1950s or 60s. Women don't have to resort to wire hangers. Is it better to maybe focus on preventing unwanted pregnancies than aborting unwanted pregnancies?
Over 90% of the work that Planned Parenthood does is prevention. We are at an all-time low for teen pregnancies, 40-year low for unintended pregnancies and abortions because of affordable, accessible birth control and sex education. The very same politicians who are banning abortion altogether are the same ones that are cutting sex education and are removing access to birth control. Look, we need to focus on what medicine and public health tell us unequivocally. Banning abortions will just stop safe, legal abortions.
We'll talk about what you face in the narrative here. In 1992, an attempt to overturn Roe v. Wade was turned back by the Supreme Court because they said at this point, women have come to depend on this choice to shape their lives. And anti-abortion activists had to show that women were actually hurt by this law. But that's not the language that we're hearing now. What we're hearing now is about the rights of the unborn and about abortion being execution. I want to ask you about that. In Wisconsin, the Democratic Governor Tony Evers recently vetoed a bill that would criminally punish doctors who don't aggressively resuscitate an infant born alive after an attempted abortion. These are, you know, late-term abortions. He said he thought protections already existed, and they do. There is the Born Alive Infants Protection Act of 2002 that guarantees personhood to those children born at any development, including after an abortion. But as you well know, President Trump described this kind of late-term abortion as a baby being born, and the doctor and the mother determine whether or not to execute the baby.
The fact is that infanticide is already illegal. President Trump is deliberately conflating infanticide, which is illegal and horrific, with abortions later in pregnancy, which is something that occurs in tragic, very challenging circumstances. As a doctor, I've treated women and families who've been in these situations when something in their pregnancy has gone very wrong. These are families that have picked out a name, built a crib, and then received the most devastating news in their lives. They're families that deserve our compassion and support.
Dr. Wen, one last question. We talked about these very restrictive, recently passed laws. It's thought the Supreme Court might not take them, but might take laws from, let's say, Indiana that more incrementally chip away at abortion rights. For instance, one law in Indiana requires a woman to undergo an ultrasound exam at least 18 hours before an abortion.
ultimately, all of these bans will have one consequence, which is to have politicians interfere with patients' private medical decision making. This goes against the will of the American people. 73% of Americans support Roe as the law of the land. Americans want more health care, not less. We want our children to be living in a world where they have more rights than we do, not fewer.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, president of Planned Parenthood, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, with the unemployment rate at the lowest level in five decades, people who left the workforce years ago are being drawn back in. And over the last 3 years, women have been entering the workforce at a faster rate than men. Why? Well, as part of a week-long series on full employment, NPR's Yuki Noguchi explores some possible explanations.
Something is spurring women of prime working age, people like Gabby Jometty, to go back to work. Before having her second child, Jometty had held various management roles around Silicon Valley. But with two kids, the demands of work became crushing.
I felt like I wasn't a good mother. I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking about my presentation or just work in general.
When her son required regular therapy appointments 4 years ago, Jometty gave up her job. She stayed at home in Santa Clara, but she missed working on team projects, and recent headlines spotlighting the need for women in technology piqued her interest.
I was curious to see, how has corporate America changed? Has it been more flexible?
In March, Jometty started what is known as a returnship, a program to recruit and retrain women like her looking to resume their careers. So far, so good, she says. That new gig managing a team at Cisco Systems gives her time to occasionally pick up her kids from school. For most of the last century, and especially after World War II, working women's ranks grew steadily. Around the year 2000, growth stopped and even started to fall. Now, once again, women are drawn in by a hot job market that's straining to find available workers. Many employers are luring workers by offering family-friendly benefits like flexible hours and paid leave. That's wooing women, who in many families remain the primary caregivers for children and elderly parents. There are other things that are contributing. The growth of industries like healthcare and education that rely heavily on women, for example. Martha Gimbel is research director at the job site Indeed.com, an NPR sponsor. She says women are also making inroads in fields like manufacturing and construction.
While those have historically been male-dominated industries, we've seen women increasingly moving into those industries, which again speaks to the way that in a tight labor market, employers are willing to look at applicants that they might have dismissed in the past.
Employers are also paying more. Gimbel says this is prompting women to find jobs.
The question will be, can wage growth support workers paying for more expensive childcare?
Childcare is, in fact, the key challenge facing working women, more so in the U.S. than in other industrialized countries. The employment gains American women have seen in recent years pale in comparison to countries like Canada and Sweden, where a higher percentage of women work. Claudia Golden is an economics professor at Harvard who studies the subject.
This is a real indication that there's something wrong.
She says women in the U.S. face greater financial headwinds, much of which is tied to their role as default caregivers in many families. Paid time off to care for children and sick family members remains relatively rare. Some cities and states require it, but U.S. law does not, and that makes it harder to keep a job. Also, Golden says, married women with spouses who also work are taxed at a higher rate, making work less lucrative. Finally, and perhaps most significantly, the U.S. does not subsidize childcare the way Canada and Europe do.
Childcare is expensive, and if a woman has a relatively low hourly wage, maybe it makes more sense for her to take care of her own children.
Even if that means earning less later in life. All of this helps explain why women have always had a complicated relationship to work. The choice to work has long been judged and criticized as a subject of culture wars. In the 1980s, it centered on latchkey children, kids with working parents who unlocked their own homes after school and looked after themselves. The Me Too movement reinvigorated the debate about unequal pay. Many employers are now trying to address that. Sonu Ratra, who took a career break, says women like her now have more options. Ratra founded Women Back to Work, a job placement and support program. She says employers are adding retraining and mentorship programs to encourage women to return and are explicitly recruiting female talent.
There has been a cultural shift in the last 2 years. Women are being celebrated more today than ever. You know, you talk about Women's History Month, you talk about Women's March, the Me Too movement.
And that shift isn't just felt by women. When Gabby Jometty decided to go back to work, both she and her husband shifted their schedules.
You know, and then we were like, oh God, like childcare, what are we gonna do about the kids?
Jometty is fortunate. Her mom and a part-time sitter can pick up the kids from school most days. Jometty and her husband alternate on others. Between her daughter's swimming and dancing and her son's baseball practices, it's still a daily logistical challenge.
Practices are at 5:30, so you have to leave work like at 4:30 in order to get them ready to scramble, and then what are you going to do about dinner?
That's a juggle, she says, that hasn't gotten any easier. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
I'm broadcasting the show today from Kentucky, where, according to the state's Distillers Association, more than 20,000 people are employed directly or indirectly by that industry. Here in Kentucky, that means bourbon. There are more than 7 million barrels of bourbon in this state of fewer than 5 million people. Bourbon was born in Kentucky, and today the industry is in the middle of a renaissance, even as trade disputes and tariffs threaten growth. But wherever that glass of bourbon is eventually served, it all starts with a 3-foot-high white oak barrel.
What makes Kentucky stand out from all the whiskey-producing regions in the world is we alone always use a new charred barrel.
Chris Morris is master distiller at Brown Forman, the company behind Jack Daniel's, Old Forester, Woodford Reserve, and many more liquor brands sold around the world. They do that in a cooperage, that's a barrel-making facility, in an old World War II-era factory near the Louisville airport. Until 1945, the military used this brick warehouse to manufacture rifle stocks and plywood parts for airplanes.
Yes, after the end of the war, the military supply contracts were ended, and we, Brown Forman, purchased the plant and converted it into a barrel cooperage, and it's been making whiskey barrels ever since.
For longer than anywhere else in America.
Yes, and not only are we the oldest cooperage, but we are also the only whiskey maker who owns a cooperage making new barrels.
Chris Morris takes us inside, where dozens of workers, including one man who's been working here for 50 years, put these barrels together with their hands and machines. They have to make sure that the 33 or so staves of wood that make up the barrel fit together perfectly and can be bound by metal hoops. If there's a crack in any of the wood, the bourbon will leak out. They test that by putting water in the barrel. If there is a leak, a cooper goes to a wall of wood, finds a piece that perfectly matches the damaged stave, and replaces it. Once the barrel is perfect, it's sent across the factory floor on a series of tracks and conveyor belts to an oven where the interior of the barrel is blasted with fire to toast and char the wood. If it weren't for this process, bourbon wouldn't have its color or its flavor. That's why these barrels will have a life even after the bourbon has been consumed.
Once we've used the barrel one time only, the wood still has a long life, a potential ahead of it, and that can be realized if you ship it to Scotland or Ireland or Canada or even to other spirit-making producing regions such as Mexico or the Caribbean for rum and tequila. They use our barrels.
But it's all about the barrel.
Yes, it is. Many spirits, all spirits, I should say, leave the stills clear. And if they have any color, there's only one way it's going to get color, and that's from wood. Now, you can add a little caramel coloring to it, but that's going to be secondary. We add no color because we, again, we're Kentucky bourbon. We're 100% natural. We add nothing to our product.
Of course, something has to go into the barrel to make bourbon, and that's where distilleries come in. For that part of the process, we visited another bourbon maker called Michter's.
We'll walk inside the still room.
Andrea Wilson is Master of Maturation and Executive Vice President for Michter's, whose origins date back to the 18th century. She says whiskey starts as a mixture of grains called mash For it to become bourbon, that mash has to be at least 51% corn. Other whiskeys usually use other grains like rye, malted barley, or wheat. Distillers boil that mash and condense the resulting vapor into what they call low wine.
Then we take that low wine, we introduce it to our pot still doubler, which is like a second refinement step or a second distillation. Gets boiled up as different compounds hit their boiling point again. They become vapor, go up to the second condenser, condense, and then they come back down, and that's what we call high wine. That's what will be evaluated for quality prior to reduction and entry into the barrel.
Then the barrels are filled with clear whiskey and hammered shut. Each barrel holds about 53 gallons of liquor and weighs about 500 pounds, so they have to be rolled along steel tracks and lifted by machines onto storehouse racks. There, they'll spend at least 5 years aging. Andrea Wilson at Michter's Distillery is also on the board of the Kentucky Distillers Association. She says 95% of the world's bourbon is made right here in Kentucky, but not all of it.
Under the U.S. law, you can produce bourbon in any of the 50 U.S. states. It was made America's native spirit in 1964, and it can be produced in any of the 50 U.S. states. But to be a Kentucky straight bourbon, you need to be produced in Kentucky.
What's the state of the industry right now? I know that the growth has been really strong over the last many years, but then, of course, along came the trade war, which has targeted bourbon specifically.
So, yeah, for Kentucky, it is a tremendous business. It's an $8.6 billion business for the state. It employs over 20,000 people. So we're very fortunate to be in an American whiskey boom. Right now, there's 7.5 million barrels of bourbon aging in Kentucky, which is the highest since 1972. So it gives you an indication of how American whiskey is going through this renaissance or essentially this growth.
Because of customers both here in the United States, but also around the world.
That's correct. And it's an amazing time for the export market. You know, trade wars are not good for anyone. No one really benefits either side. So we definitely look for the opportunity for leaders to figure out, you know, mutually beneficial outcomes that lead to a stable trade policy across the globe. And I think that's going to be incredibly important. We have seen, even last year, we saw 30% growth in our export markets.
Amid the trade war.
Amid all of that. So, you know, we do definitely feel like, you know, our product is underpinned by quality, and people are having discerning palates globally for quality, and they're willing to pay for it.
Kentucky's most famous tourist attraction is probably still the Kentucky Derby, which just happened earlier this month at Churchill Downs. But more people visit the state each year as bourbon tourists.
We're seeing over 1 million people now coming to Kentucky for the sole purpose of visiting the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, which is incredibly amazing. People want to learn more about Kentucky bourbon, and it's an exciting time. We just opened our Michter's Fort Nelson Distillery in downtown Louisville at 8th and Main. But what you're seeing is bourbon is really underpinning tourism. Our Louisville mayor calls it bourbonism. He coined the term. And I think it's brilliant because it really showcases how people are coming for the purpose of seeing the bourbon distilleries, but they're also experiencing hospitality culture, bars, restaurants. You know, we have this whole beautiful foodie culture as well. And it's an amazing time.
Once someone becomes a bourbon tourist, they're already interested in the drink. What many in the industry here are focused more on right now is convincing new customers around the world to give bourbon a try. Jackie Zykin is a master taster for Old Forester.
Well, I mean, there's still a lot of people that are still kind of scared to try it. I think a lot of people are still under this old umbrella of thought that it's this big cowboy juice diesel fuel product, and it's not. There's a lot of subtleties, and there's actually a lot of notes in there that if you broke down bourbon and described it by its different little palatable flavor compounds, people would be like, well, I like vanilla. Well, I like cinnamon. Well, I like butterscotch. Well, I like citrus. I like all of those things. So therefore, you technically, I guess, would enjoy a glass of bourbon because that's all there and present.
And she's just talking about plain old bourbon, not a mint julep or an old-fashioned, which brings me to my last question for Andrea Wilson.
Do you think it's a shame after all the work that goes into one of these barrels when somebody makes a mixed drink with your bourbon?
I don't see it. I wouldn't use that terminology at all. I think what's important is that everybody's palate is different, and how you experience your bourbon is your own personal experience. I think that what I always encourage people to do is taste bourbon neat, so you understand the spirit and understand what took years to develop in the barrel, and then create what you like. I mean, bartenders have done a brilliant job of supporting this industry all over the world by bringing back classic cocktails and using natural ingredients and bringing creativity and artistry to the drink. And that's tremendously important to our business. So however you want to drink it is your choice.
How do you drink it?
I drink it neat.
There you go. See, that from the experts, neat.
Neat.
And neat it is when it goes from those barrels into bottles after years of aging. Then packed into a cardboard box. And perhaps trucked right across the street to a waiting UPS plane. Louisville is the worldwide air hub for the shipping company, after all, and then sent all over the world. I'd raise a glass now, but I'm at work.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
Let's get an update on Brexit, because today British Prime Minister Theresa May offered UK lawmakers the chance to vote on whether there should be a second referendum on Brexit, but only if they back her deal for the UK to leave the European Union. Of course, that hasn't happened so far. Parliament has rejected May's Brexit plan 3 times, and Brexit, which was supposed to happen March 29th, has been delayed to October 31st. She plans to ask the House of Commons to vote again in early June on a withdrawal agreement bill. It's what she says is a last chance to seal the Brexit deal. Joining us now is NPR's Frank Langfitt. He's at a pro-Brexit rally in London. And Frank, give us some context for what we're hearing from the Prime Minister today, because it comes just 2 days before elections for the European Parliament, which are elections the UK wasn't even supposed to participate in.
No, not at all, Jeremy. And I think there's a sense of time sort of running out for the Prime Minister. Normally, you and I wouldn't even be talking about European parliamentary elections, but it's a huge deal here because people see it in some ways as a repeat of the referendum, to trying to get a feel for how this polarized country feels. And I'm waiting for people to take the stage here in London, arguing this is the leading party that's only a couple of months, not even a couple of months old. It's leading in the polls. It's called the Brexit Party. It wants out. For her, the Prime Minister is offering a new deal before a vote on June 7th, and that's what she was announcing today.
And she was talking about a second referendum, and I saw the headlines passing that some of her cabinet members were very unhappy that she even brought that up, but what she's saying is that they would have to vote yes on her deal to get that chance?
Exactly. And so what she says is it would be binding, and if you back me, you get to vote on whether we should take a second referendum back to the British people. But already, as you're pointing out, Jeremy, this is very unpopular. The Democratic Unionist Party called it fatally flawed. Prime Minister May relies on them to actually get bills through the parliament. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn just called it a rehash of basically what we've been discussing before. So it doesn't look like it's going anywhere. And it does have a feeling of a last chance of this prime minister who has not been able to get Brexit done.
And if she is ousted as prime minister at some point, do we go back to square one, or is it going to be easier for somebody else to try to get Brexit through?
I don't know that it is. I think many people would be very critical of her. First of all, I mean, I think it's fair to say this was an impossible job that she didn't do very well. It's very difficult to get this through the parliament here, in part because the EU has most of the leverage in this relationship. What we've already seen is many people in the parliament already beginning to gear up for a campaign to replace her. So there's a sense of politically the country sort of moving on. But exactly how they would actually do this better, or how they would come up with something new that they could get through Parliament, that's very unclear. You got to remember this: it's been almost 3 years since the vote here, and it's been very, very difficult.
And Frank, just in the 30 seconds we have left, she's talking about a vote in early June. That's when President Trump is supposed to be making a state visit to the
UK. It is. He will have just left, but it's going to be a crazy week. President Trump will be here from the 3rd to the 5th. Then the two of them will be in Normandy for D-Day commemoration, and then back here for 7th on the vote. So a wild political week in London.
All right. Well, you will be there for it, and we'll be listening. NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, thank you.
Happy to do it, Jeremy.
Today, we continue our conversation with Hassan Bennett, the 36-year-old from Philadelphia who spent 13 years in jail for masterminding a murder he said he had nothing to do with. He spent many of those years studying law. At last month's retrial, represented himself and won, in part by singing to the jury that he was like Oscar the Grouch in that Sesame Street song. He didn't belong there.
One of these things just doesn't belong here. One of these things aren't quite the same. Which one of these things just doesn't belong here? Now it's time to play our game.
Hassan also proved that his court-appointed lawyer never submitted phone records that corroborated his whereabouts, that two witnesses against him were coerced by a detective who's now on desk duty for misconduct in this and other cases. Let's pick up our conversation. So, Hassan Bennett, you submitted the phone records, you called the witnesses that corroborated your alibi, you cross-examined the two young men who were able to say publicly that they were coerced into making a statement against you and that you were not there and you were not involved. You cross-examined the homicide detective who, it's claimed, forced those confessions. And then the jury comes back and you're suddenly free.
Yeah. It felt good when the jury came back. I knew that they was going to come up with a not guilty verdict. But when I came upstairs and I realized they're not asking a question, they're coming up with an actual verdict, it felt like all my work had paid off.
It's been 13 years. I know this is still new. You tried to work a smartphone the other day. It didn't go very well.
It keeps freezing on me.
A lot has happened in 13 years. You've been reunited with a woman who's going to soon be your wife. You plan to practice law for other people in the inner city who may not have, you know, as you didn't, an awareness of the system. I'm sure there's a lot of adrenaline right now, but have you forgiven these lost 13 years?
I can't get back the time, but I can't dwell on that time either. It became a time when I was in jail that I realized that you leave jail how you go in. That's what the saying is. And it's another saying that says, do the time, don't let the time do you. So I had to go in there and I had to educate myself and not only feel the laws, just be versed in everything I can get my hands on. So when I look at the time, I can't be bitter about the time because I have a mission. I have a mission because I believe that I got found guilty because I was not able to hold counsel accountable. Mm-hmm. I got found guilty also because prosecutors withheld evidence, but I was not able to say, Your Honor, this guy is not presenting his phone records. Your Honor, this guy is not doing this. He's not objecting. Mm-hmm. He's not exploring what happened when the witness made the statement. And a percentage of me being found guilty was because of what I didn't know. So to worry about the time I did and the time in jail, I can't do that. I have to come out and help other people know. I got to educate people with what they should know, their basic rights, how to protect themselves, because without knowing, they're vulnerable.
Well, it's probably very small solace, what I'm about to say.
Mm-hmm.
13 years. I mean, and, you know, your 20s and 30s. But maybe you could look at it as a very long time in law school.
How about it? But I got to do even longer in law school.
Yeah, now you're going to get your master's.
I'm trying to. Right now, I'm working on a program that's entertaining, but it's also educational. See, when you look at Sesame Street was entertaining, but it also educated the youth. I'm working on a program that's entertaining, and it also will educate you in the field of law. And I want to put that in certain schools and so people will know their law, because as citizens, if you live in this country, if you walk this land and you don't know the privilege, your rights are the privilege you have as a citizen. If you don't know your rights, then when you walk this land, all you're doing is living under fear. And that's not how it should be.
Hassan, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. As you well know, Devon English's family, the victim's family, still thinks you are guilty. They were able to hang their sorrow on you. Now, where do they put it? Do you have some sympathy for them? Because, in fact, yes. Go ahead.
I was talking to somebody today, another friend of mine, and we were talking about that issue, how they were denied justice. It's getting lost that a person died in this. I know people praise me. Oh, you did it. You did it. You learned the law. But somebody died in this matter. Somebody, a 19-year-old, lost his life. He could have been married. He could have did anything. He could have went to school. He could have had kids. He could have been a productive member. He could have been just as relevant as any one of us around here. But he was denied it. And a family, they have an absolute right to be upset. They had somebody tell them for 13 years that I did a crime. But they also have to review the evidence. They were only called to hearings that the prosecution wanted them to see. When it was relevant for a jury sympathy, the prosecution called them to the courtroom. When I was going through my appeal phases and it came out that the prosecution withheld evidence and it came out that I had ineffective counsel, the family was not notified. So the family didn't see the progress in the case. If they would see the whole trial, they would understand that I'm not the person guilty of this crime. The description of the shooter was 5'9", 165 pounds. At the time of my arrest, I was 5'6", 125 pounds. So when they're looking at it, they're not looking at it from the evidence. They're looking at it from the people that they're supposed to trust. The prosecution is supposed to represent the state. They're supposed to represent the people. So when you have somebody supposed to represent the people telling you that this person did it, that your trust is in them because you are looking at them to seek justice. So they have a right to be angry, but the anger shouldn't fall on me. As a matter of fact, I was talking this morning and I said, we should do something for Devon. We should base the foundation for Devon.
Let us know when you do. Hassan Bennett, the Philadelphia man who acted as his own attorney and just acquitted himself of murder after 13 years in jail. Hassan, thanks very much.
I would like to thank you, too.
Well, we've heard from many listeners asking, how can Hassan's story be? Let's just touch base with Emily Bazelon, journalist and Yale lecturer, and we'll link you to our conversation about her new book, Charged, at hearnow.org. And so, Emily, a court-appointed attorney doesn't submit evidence like phone records. A homicide detective coerces witnesses. I'm betting, having talked to you about your book, this does not surprise you.
It doesn't surprise me, but it's also not routine, and it should shock us, even if it's not something that, you know, has never happened before.
Well, and tell us more about the probability of, you know, a court-appointed lawyer not submitting phone records.
The problem with court-appointed defense lawyers in our country is we don't have any national system for funding them or making sure that they're doing their jobs properly and that they're not overwhelmed by their number of clients and that they're really good enough to be up to the task of doing a homicide trial.
Well, in fact, some of us have been in courtrooms and we've seen, you know, sometimes court-appointed lawyers, they may have 15 cases in a day.
Yes, it is common for defense lawyers to have cases stacked up, and sometimes communities pay more for a trial, but not necessarily enough more to allow for lots of preparation. On the other hand, what we have in Hassan Bennett's case is a finding from the court that his lawyer provided what's called ineffective assistance. That means the lawyer did such a bad job that Hassan Bennett got a new trial. And when you see that, there's really no excuse for it. Lawyers are not supposed to take cases where they can't do an adequate job of representation. And so while it's really important to understand the burdens on the system and the idea that we should provide more money for it, it's also true that lawyers have a legal obligation to go through all the evidence and make sure they are representing their clients properly.
And of course, as we mentioned, the homicide detective in this case, who was accused of coercing witnesses in other cases as well, has been relegated to desk duty, so that's been acknowledged. Emily, though, what about someone successfully defending themselves with just a high school education? How often does that happen?
That's very unusual, and it seems like Hassan Bennett was incredibly determined and confident in a way that was persuasive to the jury. I love the story because it's about someone teaching himself law with the help of someone else in prison who was what's known as a jailhouse lawyer, someone who is able to self-educate himself. And, you know, we used to have more of a tradition of this in this country where people used to go to night school to learn to practice law, and they used to be able to become lawyers with more apprenticing themselves as opposed to formal education. Now it's really unusual, but Hassan Bennett obviously knew the facts of his own case incredibly well. And it sounds like he was able to boil down the key issues here in a simple, vivid way that really convinced the jury.
Emily Bazelon, her book on the justice system, a great read, is Charged. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a new troubling warning about climate change. A new study shows world sea levels could rise 6 feet by the end of this century if emissions go unchecked. That's double the earlier estimate from the UN Climate Science Panel. The new research is published in the Proceedings of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. And joining us now is Professor Jonathan Bamber of the University of Bristol in the U.K. He's the lead author of this new study, and he's on Skype. Professor, tell us more about your findings. What does your research say?
Well, so, I mean, one of the questions I've been asked is, you know, why are the numbers so much bigger? And it's an obvious question. You know, did they get something wrong in the IPCC report, you know, the UN report that was published 6-7 years ago? And I wouldn't say they necessarily got anything wrong, but there's two key things that are kind of developments, if you like, in our study. One is that in the last 6 years or so since the IPCC report was published in 2013, we've realized that there are some important processes that affect the ice sheets, particularly Antarctica, that weren't included in the numerical models and the simulations previously. And that is one reason why the uncertainties have grown. And the second is that we're looking at a worst case scenario. You know, it could happen, but it's certainly not the most likely scenario.
And when you talk about different processes that are affecting the Antarctic ice sheet, what are those?
Yeah, so one of them is something called the marine ice cliff instability. This is only really important for the high-end warming scenarios that we consider in our study. That is like 5 degrees warming by 2100. At those kind of levels of warming, the ice shelves that buttress much of the grounded ice sheet in the interior of Antarctica, they start to melt away quite rapidly. And you get rapid ice loss. And that's a process that could be important, but it has certainly increased our range of possible future behaviors of Antarctica in particular.
Well, and if the worst case scenario that you're talking about comes true, what are the implications of that?
They're pretty grim. We're talking about existential threat to small island nations like the Marshall Islands in the Pacific and other atolls in the Pacific. They will become, at 2 meters of sea level rise, those small island states will become uninhabitable. We're talking about massive loss of land, you know, an area the size of Libya. We're talking about displacement of up to 187 million people, potentially. That is an awful lot of people, you know, who are going to have to move to somewhere else.
And just to give people a sense of how many people that is, 187 million people, there were 1 million people who came to Europe as a result of the Syrian refugee crisis, and that overwhelmed a lot of countries.
Absolutely right. It's caused social discontent, social upheaval, and political upheaval, you know, throughout Europe. And that was, what, like, almost 200 times smaller number of people. So you kind of get an idea of how incredibly disruptive something like 2 meter sea level rise would be. It doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking, you know, I mean, places like Florida, some of the major coastal cities, New York, San Francisco, Rio de Janeiro, Shanghai, London. We're not necessarily saying loss of life, but we're saying that you know, massive parts of the infrastructure of those huge cities will become unusable. And, you know, rather than kind of nuisance flooding that you get now, you're talking about daily flooding events and really pretty grim consequences.
And yet, you know, when we think about all of the stories that we hear and all the studies that come out that say things like what you're saying, maybe not exactly this, but pretty similar, it seems like it comes and goes without any real change with regard to climate change regulation, legislation all around the world.
That's a hard comment a hard point for me to comment on, because, I mean, that really relates to, I think, the response from politicians and policymakers. Certainly,
but isn't that what has to happen in order for something real to change on this
issue?
Absolutely
right. Absolutely right. And I think that, you know, the Paris Agreement that was signed in 2015, I think, was a landmark agreement. Almost 200 nations signed up to that. That the trouble is that at the minute, it seems that it was largely kind of rhetoric rather than real action. So even since 2015, we've seen an increase in greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So things aren't going in the right direction. But having said that, you know, I do sense that there is a change in mood. I mean, not just amongst the public, but amongst politicians as well. So the UK government have declared it a climate emergency. So I think there is a sea change taking place. Whether we act quickly enough to avert some of the worst consequences of climate change remains to be seen. But it is in our gift to do that. We can do it. It's not an insurmountable challenge.
That is Jonathan Bamber, who's a professor of geography at the University of Bristol. He's the lead author of a new study that says the world's seas are rising faster than previously thought. Professor, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. We want to thank our hosts here at Louisville Public Media in Louisville, Kentucky, including Stephen George, Erica Peterson, Kate Howard, Ryland Barton, Caitlin McGlade, Jeff Young, Charles Spivey, and our engineer, Russell Wells. Our Kentucky broadcast was produced by Chris Bentley, and our stories were mixed by Mike Moschetto.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at Louisville Public Media in Louisville, Kentucky. This is Here and Now.